Today on Family Talk.
Most experts are expecting the Supreme Court to strike down all laws prohibiting gay marriage in the United States when they announce their ruling this June. This will be a monumental decision and one that I am dreading. So how did we get to this point? Were there any warning signs that this would happen one day? Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and today we're going to wind back the clock and enjoy a classic broadcast where my dad was discussing problems within the Supreme Court that have impacted us today. Normally, when people discuss lessons from our founding fathers, they are talking about John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and others. But today, my dad is going to talk about the history of the Supreme Court and some of the early heroes of America, like Justice John Jay. Now, for those of you that won't be able to stay with us throughout today's program, I want to let you know there couldn't be a better time to join the Ministry of Family Talk through your financial support. Thanks to an offer of a matching donation from one of our friends, every gift we receive this month, up to a total of $200,000, will be matched dollar for dollar. That means that your donation today can make a real difference in the lives of twice as many families. And to say thank you for your gift, we will send you my dad's latest book, Your Legacy, and the DVD from our brand new film series, Building a Family Legacy. To join the mission of Family Talk and impact twice as many families today, visit our website, drjamesdobson.org, or call us at 877-732-6825. Here now is Dr. Dobson on today's edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
What we want to do today is to deal with one of my monthly letters. It deals with United States Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who gave a speech in the month of April that was addressed to people of faith, specifically about Christians who have the audacity to take the scriptures literally, who really do believe when God said it that he meant it. And he talked about the oppression that is so common today and the disdain with which the beliefs of Christians are held by those in the cultural elite. His remarks, as might be predicted, brought the roof down. Columnists and historians and law professors protested vehemently about what he said. And mainly they said he had no right to speak about his faith at all, that government officials, especially high government officials, should never talk about their religious views. You know, it ought to be a kind of a private thing that nobody knows is there because it is never shared. This is what the reporters and the columnists complained about. They said that Scalia especially should be the most secular of all our public officials. Well, let's see. To get a fix on that, we began looking at what his predecessors on the Supreme Court had said. Let's start with the Honorable John Jay, who was the first justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who also served as a governor of New York. And he said, "Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers." In 1892, Justice David Brewer, writing for the majority in the case of Church of the Holy Trinity versus United States, said this, "This is a religious people. This is historically true. From the discovery of this continent to the present hour, there is a single voice making this affirmation. We find everywhere a clear recognition of the same truth. These and many other matters, which might be noted, add a volume of unofficial declaration to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation." That was 1892. Justice William O. Douglas in 1952. So this is not just ancient history. William O. Douglas said, "We are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being." There is a wonderful quote of former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, who was not remembered as a conservative jurist, as you know. He's thought of as a liberal. I don't have time to read his entire quote, but it was printed word for word in Time magazine in 1954. I'll just read the end of it, which gets the essence of what he said. "I believe the entire Bill of Rights came into being because of the knowledge our forefathers had of the Bible and their belief in it. Freedom of belief, of expression, of assembly, of petition, the dignity of the individual, the sanctity of the home, equal justice under law, and the reservation of powers to the people. I like to believe we are living today in the spirit of the Christian religion. I like also to believe that as long as we do so, no great harm can come to our country. Isn't that an incredible quote? Well, there have been so many other strong statements of faith by justices of the Supreme Court, and I don't have time to read them. Let's jump now to some of the quotes from our presidents, from the chief executives, beginning with George Washington. He addressed a prayer to, O most glorious God in Jesus Christ, and he concluded with these words, Let me live according to those holy rules which thou hast this day prescribed in thy holy word. Direct me to the true object, Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. Bless, O Lord, all the people of this land. That was 1752. John Adams, our first vice president and our second president, we have a quote from nearly every president. John Adams said, Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. 1798. Got a great quote by Thomas Jefferson. I'll skip it. Our sixth president, John Quincy Adams, said this, No book in the world deserves to be so unceasingly studied and so profoundly meditated upon as the Bible. That was about 1812. Andrew Jackson, our seventh president, made this statement, Sir, I am in the hands of a merciful God. I have full confidence in His goodness and mercy. The Bible is true. I have tried to conform to its spirit as near as possible. Upon that sacred volume I rest my hope for eternal salvation through the merits and blood of our blessed Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, 1845. Abraham Lincoln, his quotations about the Bible and about Scripture would fill an entire book. I've chosen my favorite to share, and he wrote this in 1863, right in the middle of the Civil War. He said, We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power, as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. We have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. What a beautiful prayer. Theodore Roosevelt made a great statement. Woodrow Wilson, our 28th president and former governor of New Jersey, said, America was born a Christian nation. America was born to exemplify that devotion to the elements of righteousness which are derived from the revelations of Holy Scripture. That was 1911. Franklin Roosevelt prayed a prayer on June 6, 1944, D-Day. Harry Truman, our 33rd president, wasn't known to be a deeply committed believer. Nevertheless, he understood this spiritual heritage that we're discussing here. He said, If men and nations would but live by the precepts of the ancient prophets and the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount, problems which now seem so difficult would soon disappear. That is a supreme opportunity for the church to continue to fulfill its mission on earth. The Protestant church, the Catholic church, and the Jewish synagogue, bound together in the American unity of brotherhood, must provide the shock forces to accomplish this moral and spiritual awakening. No other agency can do it. Unless it is done, we're headed for the disaster we would deserve. Oh, for an Isaiah or a St. Paul to reawaken a sick world to its moral responsibilities. 1946, that's pretty strong stuff. In fact, I saw an article the other day about the city of Denver. It was from the newspaper in 1911, I believe it was, and it said the town was virtually shut down for a time of prayer. The last one, Ronald Reagan, our 40th president, gave a speech in which he included this statement, The frustrating thing is that those who are attacking religion claim that they're doing it in the name of tolerance, freedom, and open-mindedness. Question, isn't the real truth that they are intolerant of religion? They refuse to tolerate its importance in our lives. That was expressed in 1984. Now, these are just some of the quotations, the expressions of faith offered by our chief executives through nearly 220 years of American history. And we're not just talking about the founding fathers. The motto, "In God We Trust," was adopted by Congress as recently as 1956. This is who we are. This is where we've been. There are hundreds of other quotes that exist in the record, including some I hate not to read by military heroes, authors, and patriots such as Benjamin Franklin, Patrick Henry, and Robert E. Lee. I just can't read these writings without marveling at the spiritual heritage that's been handed down to us through the ages. But these statements of faith also evoke in us a certain sadness over what's happening now to our great country. We're witnessing an unprecedented campaign to secularize our society and demoralize our institutions from the top down. The effort has been enormously successful. Most forms of prayer have been declared unconstitutional in the nation's schools, even that which is student-initiated. The Ten Commandments have been prohibited on school bulletin boards. Secular universities are blatantly hostile to Christian precepts. And the media screams foul whenever someone like Justice Scalia openly expresses his beliefs. In this wonderful land of the free, we have gagged and bound all of our public officials, our teachers, our elected representatives, and our judges. Since we have effectively censored these and their expressions of faith in public life, the predictable is happening. A generation of young people is growing up with very little understanding of the spiritual principles on which our country was founded. And we wonder why so many of them can kill, steal, and take drugs and engage in promiscuous sex with no pangs of conscience. We have taught them that right and wrong are arbitrary. They're subjective. They're changing. They learned their lessons well. Having turned the culture upside down, then, the secularists appear to have agreed upon three specific mechanisms to complete the task of immobilizing and silencing conservative Christians. You can find evidence of these strategies in your own communities and schools. Let me share them. The first is the goal of denying our Judeo-Christian roots and rewriting our historical record. Children in the public schools, for example, have never heard the expressions of faith that I've just cited. They celebrate the Pilgrims' first Thanksgiving each November on this continent, but they're not told to whom those early settlers were thankful. God has been excised from that story and every other account of devotion or dependence on Him. It's as though our ancestors were entirely pagan in their beliefs. As the quotations I've read have shown, nothing could be farther from the truth. Fortunately, those who would rid us of our spiritual heritage have an impossible task on their hands. To sanitize our history, it would be necessary to expunge all official records, burn all the old textbooks, close the Library of Congress, destroy existing diaries and letters, and sandblast half the buildings in Washington, D.C. And still the evidences of our faith would exist. An image of Moses faces the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Our coins proclaim, "In God We Trust." Our Pledge of Allegiance declares that we are, quote, "one nation under God." Our Declaration of Independence asserts that we are, quote, "endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights." The oath of office for the presidency ends with the phrase, "So help me God," and on it goes. Given this vast volume of historical evidence, it is utterly foolish to deny that we have been, from the beginning, a people of faith whose government is built wholly on a Judeo-Christian foundation. Yet those of our people who do not study history can be duped into believing anything. The second objective of the revisionist is to convince the American people that Christians, specifically those with conservative inclinations, are in violation of the Constitution whenever they advocate their views beyond the front door of their sanctuaries. Just keep your mouth shut. You can believe it, just don't advocate it or work for it. Liberal activists would have us believe that our founding fathers were terrified at the prospect of Christians participating in the political process. This led them, we're told, to protect the government from religious meddling. But no such provision appears in the Constitution or any of the foundational documents. The principle of separation of church and state is found only in one of Jefferson's letters, and referred not to the exclusion of religious people from government, but to the protection of religion from governmental interference. Now, Jefferson's personal comment in that private letter, which was never endorsed or ratified by Congress or the electorate, has been twisted in its meaning and given the weight of constitutional law. Listen to the rhetoric of those who seek to suppress Christian participation in government. It's become more oppressive and extreme year by year. And by the way, when liberals work for what they believe, they're never accused of imposing their will on others. Only when Christians seek to advocate their views are they said to be oppressively shoving those views down everyone else's throats. President Bill Clinton also spoke out against what he called, quote, the extreme conservative movement in America, end quote. He said he disliked calling them religious conservatives, which he considered a misnomer. Instead, he used the term radical right. In 1994, Mr. Clinton represented the United States at the 50th anniversary remembrance of the Normandy invasion in France. He said of that occasion, quote, it occurred to me that those people, referring to the men who risked their lives on those bloody beaches, did not die so the American people could indulge themselves in the luxury of cynicism. Now, think about that comment for a moment. Who in government is qualified to evaluate our private attitudes and our comments and determine which of them is and is not appropriate? I submit that those brave men in Normandy did give their lives to preserve for us the luxury of thinking and saying whatever seems right to us, even if our ideas appear unacceptable to those in power. It's known as freedom of speech, and it is gloriously protected in the Bill of Rights. Yes, it even includes that which is deemed by some to be cynical. It's not just the politicians who would limit the participation in government of those with whom they disagree. Every year, the American Library Association publishes a list, which is eagerly awaited by the media, that cites censorship episodes in the past 12 months. The vast majority of the examples given represent concerns expressed by parents about what their own children are reading and seeing. That, they say, is censorship. Of great concern to me is Christians are starting to try to limit the views of other Christians with which they disagree. In the May 20th, 1996 edition of Christianity Today, Senior editor, Edward C. Dobson, who's no relation to me, published an article entitled Taking Politics Out of the Sanctuary. And it offers the rhetoric heard commonly today among pastors and theologians who seek to disengage the church from the culture in which it exists. Like others who have made this case, the author draws no distinction between political issues, such as the election of candidates to public office, and the profound moral issues that are debated in the political arena. He categorically states we should keep the church out of partisan politics and political action. I wonder if he would perceive physician-assisted suicide, voluntary and involuntary, to be partisan and political. I wonder if there's anything occurring in public policy that he would consider of relevance to the church. I thank God when slavery was rampant in the 19th century, some pastors in their congregations had the courage to confront this, the most partisan and political issue in American history. Reverend Charles G. Finney, the great 19th century evangelist, understood the vital role of the church in influencing public policy. He wrote in the early 1800s, "The time has come that Christians must vote for honest men and take consistent ground in politics. God cannot sustain this free and blessed country, which we love and pray for, unless the church will take right ground." If I appear to be overreacting to the efforts to censor people of faith, be assured that hundreds of others have also expressed the concern for what is happening. And then I listed a number of quotes from secular sources who recognize this effort to silence a segment of society. The third strategy of the secularist is to embarrass, insult, shout down, and mischaracterize conservative Christians, hoping to intimidate them into silence. You know, they give us names: radical right, far right, extreme right, Christian right, for believing things that everybody believed in the culture 50 years ago. You know, nobody believed in killing unborn babies 50 years ago. The things that are held by conservative Christians are not radical. They are consistent with Scripture, from my perspective at least. And there is an effort to try to intimidate those who would hold those views. Unbelievably, the Oklahoma City bombing was blamed on the Christian movement before they even knew who did it. Reporter Bruce Morton wrote, "What do you suppose the odds are that when they finally know who did it, they will say, 'Well, I was following God's will'?" That is so typical. You talk about arrogance and bias in the media. Bruce Morton and other reporters blamed Christians for blowing up 168 people, many of them children, with no basis in fact. Can you imagine what would happen if you blamed Jews or Native Americans or African Americans or union members or environmentalists or abortionists or feminists or homosexuals of killing people with no basis in fact and no evidence to support it? Well, I thank God that our laws still protect those of us who speak for unborn children and defend the principles of righteousness. Stephen Carter, Yale professor and author of the book The Culture of Disbelief, said, "Religious people are as fully members of American society as anyone else, as are people who are not religious. If you want to disagree with them, disagree with them. If you want to argue against them, do that. But don't ever suggest that because they are religious people, they somehow have less right to be in the public square than other people do." There's a wonderful Supreme Court decision, McDaniel versus Patty, that says precisely that. I don't have time to read it. Let me go to the last paragraph. "Unless I intend to turn this letter into a book, I must bring it to a close. I know it's too long, but how could I have edited this message of such importance to a nation and to the followers of Jesus Christ? We live in a representative form of government wherein we are its leaders. Abraham Lincoln said America is a nation governed of the people, by the people, and for the people, and that includes people of faith. It also means every citizen has a responsibility to participate in the decisions that are made and to use his or her influence for that which is moral and just. When teenagers are given immoral advice and condoms paid for with tax dollars, we're obligated to object. And when courageous men like Justice Antonin Scalia speak openly about their Christian beliefs, we must defend their right to do so. The revisionists must not prevail in their efforts to make this a post-Christian nation that abandons its precious heritage. With God's help, they will not succeed."
We've been enjoying a classic program with my dad discussing the history of the Supreme Court here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and as I mentioned at the top of the program, this June, most experts are predicting that the Supreme Court will strike down all laws prohibiting gay marriage in the United States. This will be a monumental decision and one that we are already beginning to prepare for. As you know, our mission is to preserve and promote the institution of the family and to stand for righteousness in the culture. Regardless of what the Supreme Court decides, we will not back down from our support of truth. If you'd like to support this mission and help us stand up for families, right now is the best time to give. Generous friends of Family Talk have stepped forward with a $200,000 conditional match that effectively doubles every gift we receive through the end of the month. Call today to donate, 877-732-6825, or visit our website, drjamesdobson.org. And to thank you for your donation, we want to get you two powerful resources in your hands to help you build legacies of faith in your family. We'll send you a copy of my dad's new book, Your Legacy, and the DVD that goes with it from our new film series, Building a Family Legacy. Again, you can donate by calling us, 877-732-6825, or at our website, drjamesdobson.org, and we thank you in advance. This is Ryan Dobson saying God bless, thanks for listening today, and we'll see you again next time for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
Hi, everyone. Ryan Dobson here. Do you want to know what the best decision my parents made on my behalf was? It was their decision to basically force me, that's right, at 17 years of age, to go to Summit Ministries for a two-week camp. The truths about God and the world that I learned at Summit went on to shape the rest of my life and has led me to where I am today. Well, I have some exciting news about how you can save a bunch of money on sending your son or daughter to Summit. Summit has agreed to offer a $200 discount to Family Talk listeners if they use the promo code FAMILY15. Again, $200 off by using the code FAMILY15. Don't wait, because this offer ends soon. Go to summit.org today. Again, summit.org to sign up your teenager today.